And now again, we've had this very, very big run. Market's overbought. Breadth is deteriorating here a bit. And now we're sucking in kind of the retail investor. The retail investors are now starting to jump into the market kind of with both feet. And that's kind of that setup that we're going to get some type of reversal. But that could be, we could go another 100 points higher on the S&P before we have that correction.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm Thoughtful Money founder and your host, Adam Taggart, welcoming you back here at the end of the week for another weekly market recap for my, I didn't come up with an adjective for you this week.
We'll just call it cranky today. I'm cranky.
Cranky. Okay. My cranky good friend, Lance Roberts, yeah. Portfolio manager of Real Investment Advisors. You gave me the opening, Lance. Why cranky?
Because, you and I, we really watch, take care of our health, and, we try to eat right. We try to exercise. And I've had a vice for a long time, which is coffee with a little bit of sweetener in it. Not a lot, just a little bit of sweetener in it. So I have now given up my last vice, which is sweetener in my coffee. So I'm cranky.
Oh, man. And what's this for?
You read more and more stuff about the impact of sugar on your cortisol levels, as well as your insulin levels. And, it's just all has a lot of negative byproducts. And so trying to take care of my health is just trying to give up one of my last vices. So I'm cranky.
All right. Oh, I get it, man. And that's tough. One of the nutrition books I read early on that kind of, set me on my healthier eating plan had a chapter in it called Sugar is the Devil.
Yes.
And I think if you take that mindset, actually, it really does help, begin to see, you begin to become aware that sugar is an absolutely everything. It's a really hard thing to try to get out of your system, or find sugar.
Well, and it is. It's great. Like, we have all these drugs now, to help you lose weight. Eli Lilly, of course, that stock just taking off to the moon on this whole, this whole issue of semiglutides. And it's all great. It's fine and dandy that, what these drugs do is just make you not want to eat. And, but we're not changing the dieting behaviors of individuals. So as soon as they come off the drug, they immediately gain all the weight back, because that's just how the body reacts. And one of the biggest problems with trying to lose body fat is sugar, because your body, when you exercise, it'll burn sugar first instead of burning fat. So if you're trying to lose body fat, sugar is one of the worst things that you can intake to break down body fat.
Well, absolutely. And look, this isn't a nutritional podcast, but, even if you have a little bit of sugar when you're eating something, to your point, your body says, oh, sugar, that's the easy stuff, right? So it burns that, and then it just stores everything else that you're eating, fat. So even not that much sugar in your mind can actually still be a real thwart to your plans if you really want to lose weight.
Right. And it's not even that. It's not just sugar. It's, artificial sweeteners and everything else that the body.
Well, and simple carbs too, which burn down into, simple sugars that the body then burns. Yeah.
And so now I'm on this whole new agenda, doing what's called carb cycling. And, that's where, look, you need carbohydrates to lose body fat, which goes against a lot of, kind of the fad diets that are out there. But you actually need carbohydrates to burn fat. But it's important to make sure that when you consume your carbohydrates, that you're consuming those carbohydrates on days that you're having really intense workouts, because the body needs that to help build muscle, burn fat, et cetera. On days that you're not working out, or you're just going to go for a long walk, those are the days that you really cut back on your carbohydrates. So this carb cycling, and this is how, when you see a lot of actors and actresses, they'll lose a bunch of weight right before a movie. That's what they're doing. That's the secret to losing body fat really quickly, is doing carb cycling.
All right, folks. Well, look, we're obviously changing the name to Thoughtful Health. Welcome to the Thoughtful Health Podcast.
Sorry. I know it's probably not of interest to anybody, but it's...
But you and I, but
you
we
asked
could...
You asked me, well, I'm cranky. That's why I'm cranky.
All right. Well, look, as you see a future podcast, folks, as Lance just gets thinner and thinner and thinner, you'll know why now. All right. Well, look.
I'm taking the family to Greece this summer, so I got to get my, my.
Oh, you're getting your beach body.
Exactly.
Oh, nice. All right. Well, look. Lots to talk about, Lance. You told me you got a bit of a time constraint today. You said you weren't going to talk very much, and I knew that was only going to last about 3 milliseconds. And here we are talking about, carb cycling. But let's see. Let's start with the markets. The run in the S&P continues. So I don't know where we are now, but yesterday ended up, well over 5,000, right? 5,025 or something like that when I looked at it yesterday. So we're going to talk about the inflation numbers in just a minute, but when the January inflation report came out, the market actually had a little bit of a swoon. Didn't last very long. So it seems like the animal spirits are still in control here. What are you seeing in terms of the momentum of the market?
Well, no, that's it. I'm actually writing an article for Tuesday right now talking about why you shouldn't fear all-time highs. And it's always interesting because when markets are making all-time highs, people are going, "Oh my gosh, the market's going to crash now." No, it's just, this is a function of exuberance and it's a function of psychology and confidence. And if we take, we've talked about our technical indicators are, running at very, very high levels right now. But that's part of that exuberance in the market. People are just, as an example, there's a stock that is, had an announcement by Nvidia. It's a small cap Russell stock, SMCI, which is like a little bitty small semiconductor company. The stock's up like 800% or something in the last 3 weeks. I mean, it's just gone just virtually parabolic. It reminds me a lot of the AMC days when we would see AMC and some of these companies just go straight up as kind of all the Reddit traders start chasing. And we're seeing that exact same bullish sentiment now starting to invade, kind of some of the retail areas of the markets. Call options by retail investors on the Russell 2000 index are extremely high right now. So, we're just seeing a lot of that bullish exuberance. People are just jumping into the markets. The market's just going to go up from here. It's fantastic. And that can last a lot longer than you expect. So don't fear all-time highs. Just understand that that's a function of psychology. And we are getting rather late into this game. This type of attitude where investors are kind of throwing caution to the wind and just buying everything now is something that happens kind of late in that game. Remember, this market started rallying back in October. Back in October, nobody wanted to own stocks. You and I were sitting there talking about the extreme negative sentiment. Everybody was like, "Oh, this bear market's back, and it's just going to go down from here." And we were like, "Nope, be careful. When we get November, December, buybacks come back. You've got super negative sentiment. This is all a good setup for a bull market run." And we've had a very strong bullish advance since November. And this can continue for a while longer. Now, having said that, it's important to understand that we are kind of getting into a seasonal period here. February and March tend to be a little bit weaker. So we could see this market kind of flop around here, consolidate a bit. And then we get another run into the summer. Now, September and October, wouldn't be surprised to see a 5 to 10% correction sometime this summer. That would be very normal. A for the market just to have a correction, right? So it's not bad. That's actually a good thing. But normally markets correct going into a presidential election because we don't know for sure who's going to win the election. So, if Biden wins, then I kind of know what I'm going to get policy-wise. But if Trump wins, I really have no idea what I'm going to get policy-wise. So we could see markets sell off going into the election and then get back onto a bull track, after the election once we know who the candidate, who the new president's going to be, and then we can start pricing in what we think policies are. It's going to be tax cuts or tax, whatever it's going to be.
Okay, so help me square the circle then in the short term here, because I hear you saying, don't fear the higher prices. They don't necessarily mean the system's going to correct hard anytime soon. But then you say, but we're getting really stretched in some of these technicals, and we're seeing these sort of late stage signs that we oftentimes see in kind of a top that then gets reversed. So, how are you holding those two things in your mind at the same time here? Because they sound somewhat oppositional.
Well, they do, but just understand that a 5 to 10% correction in the market, like we had last summer. You and I in June, July last year, we're talking about, hey, we're going to have a 5 to 10% correction in the market. Very similar to where we are today. Had technical indicators at very, very overbought levels. We had sentiment extremely high back in June, July. It was all about the artificial intelligence chase. And we were like, hey, we're going to have this correction during the summer. And we had that 10% correction, completely normal, by the way. But that was just that reset that reverted that big deviation between the 200-day moving average and where the market was. We now have a bigger deviation between the market and the 200-day moving average than we had back then. So a reversal back to the 200-day moving average, completely normal, very healthy for this for a market. If it happened tomorrow, if the markets went down to the 200-day moving average tomorrow, it'd be about 40, 4550, 4600 on the 200-day moving average. So that's a 400-point decline from, where we are at 5,000.
All right. Do you want to pull up your normal S&P chart here just so we can sort of see how much room there is to fall if we do get that kind of correction? While you're doing that, I'll mention and let you comment on this. But so I grew up in New England, in coastal New England, and there were times of the year where the bluefish would run. And what they would do is they would chase schools of fish into an inlet or wherever the fish couldn't escape. And then the bluefish would just, it was like a feeding frenzy, right? And the bluefish fishermen would say, you don't even need bait during that time. Like you can just cast a naked hook out into there and be catching bluefish because they'll just bite anything, right? Are we kind of getting to that sort of equivalent in the market right now?
Yeah, in a way, yes. We're still not seeing we're not seeing, one of the concerns we have right now, short term, is the. So if you take a look at the number of stocks trading above
All right.
their
And sorry, Lance,
50-day.
you glitched out there for a second. We didn't get the keyword that's the
Oh.
concern. What's the concern?
The concern is breadth.
Breath,
The
okay.
breadth of the market is not fantastic. If we take a look at the 50-day moving average, the stocks above their 50-day, the stocks above their 200-day moving average, stocks above their 10 or 20-day moving averages, those aren't real healthy. And those are actually declining. So we have a negative divergence between breadth and the market itself, which is typically a decent precursor to having some sort of correction. And so if you kind of look back at where we were last July, we had a fairly big deviation between the market and the 200-day moving average, this black line down here. Markets were overbought. We were flirting around with the sell signal up top. Finally got that sell signal in late July, had the reversal back to the 200-day moving average. And now again, we've had this very, very big run. Market's overbought, breadth is deteriorating here a bit. And now we're sucking in kind of the retail investor. The retail investors are now starting to jump into the market kind of with both feet. And that's kind of that setup that we're going to get some type of reversal. But that could be, we could go another 100 points higher on the S&P before we have that correction. And so, this is what I'm saying about, all-time highs. Those aren't things to fear. It's just understanding that markets are very exuberant right now, and we're eventually going to have a correction. And this is why on Monday last week, we just started taking profits and rebalancing the portfolio a little bit just to kind of prepare for, some type of corrective action in the markets when it comes.
All right. So let me restate what you're saying then and see if I'm understanding it correctly. You're saying be cautious right now because the odds of a correction, and I'll put 5 to 10% in your words out there, the odds are rising for that. But don't fear it in the sense that oh, that means when the market turns, we're going to get some massive crash that's going to be the big one. You're saying we may just have a nice little corrective pause or little dip in this run, but then markets could recover and go even higher.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, this and again, kind of the point that I'm really trying to make here is not to over exaggerate your moves. I get, generally when I say something like, hey, the markets are set up here for a 5 or 10% correction, immediately I get emails, well, why don't you just sell everything and go to cash and wait for the correction? Well, the problem with that is that the market could be 5 to 10% higher before that ever occurs. And, this market's been overbought since really December of last year. So if I just acted on that notion, say, oh, market's overbought, I'm going to cash and wait. Well, I've missed all the rally in January and February by sitting in cash. And so this is why it's important for investors to understand what the risk is, understand that there is a potential that there is going to be some corrective action in the future. Begin to take a few profits. So, in other words, if you have a position in your portfolio that's 5% of your portfolio normally, and it's now six because it's had a big run up, trim it back to five, take those profits in, put those in cash, and then wait for a better opportunity. And that's what we are doing. And when we do have a 5 to 10% correction, we'll be looking to buy, you know, on the way down. Just like we, if you remember last year, Adam, we were talking about in October, you know, we were buying stocks in October while the market was going down. Everybody's like, why are you buying stocks? They're just going down. It's like, because we're getting ready for a rally and I want to try to buy some of these things a little bit cheaper than they were, you know, back in January, February. So, you know, that, you know, use markets to your advantage. Don't be afraid of them. Use markets to your advantage to help you manage your portfolio longer term.
Okay. And in managing your risk of the short-term correction that you think could happen here, are you primarily just selling some positions and building more cash right now, or are you using any other downside hedges, like, I don't know, you know, puts or anything like that to cushion should indeed we get a 5 or 10% correction?
Well, not yet, because again, the market's giving you no indication that we're going into corrective mode. So I don't want to start short. Okay, so when we manage a portfolio, there's a couple of things we can do. One, the step one is kind of small action. So step one is just to sell positions that are over target weight, bring those back to target weight, stocks that are under target weight, but that we like, you know, maybe we add to those a little bit, and we just kind of rebalance the portfolio to get the volatility structure we want relative to the market. The second step is to actually begin reducing equity exposure. So as the market breaks the 20-day moving average, starts to maybe break the 50-day moving average, now we start reducing. We've got clear sell signals across the board. Now we're going to start reducing equity exposure. So this is where we go from, you know, 60 or 70% target equity to, you know, 40 or 50% target equity, or 35 to 40. If the indications are that this is more than just kind of a normal run-of-the-mill short-term correction, then we do what's called shorting against the box. And that is where we then add short positions to offset long positions that we don't want to sell, period, right? So there's companies that we will probably in our portfolio have no intention of selling anytime soon. We'll be looking to buy those a lot cheaper, but I can short against those temporarily to hedge off portfolio risk. But that's when you're in a much more directed decline in the markets. 2022, really, you know, we had such big rallies in the 2022 sell-off. It was never a good market to short against, because as soon as you got a signal to short, the market would take off running on hopes the Fed was about to start cutting rates. And so you kept getting whipsawed in your short positions. But if you get into a more normalized kind of bearish market correction, where it's kind of just trending low over time, that's a great market to start shorting against the box.
Okay. All right. Well, look, it doesn't seem that there's much that can really, that has diminished the market's enthusiasm right now. As I mentioned, we got a few days ago, we got the January inflation numbers, CPI, core CPE, and they both increased more than Wall Street was expecting, right? And, you know, that we can argue, and everybody already is, you know, whether that's just a blip or whether that's a sign that inflation is going to be stickier to tame. You know, the last remnants of inflation are going to be harder to get rid of than what's been brought down so far. But we don't know yet. Time will prove out. But that can't be super helpful to the Fed. Right. You know, the Fed basically, you know, it had its dovish jawboning pivot in December, and financial conditions have just like completely loosened. Right. Yep. And then now, you know, the official numbers that the Fed, you know, says that it watches are kind of going in the wrong direction. And so, you know, potentially and maybe sensibly, well, that might push out the arrival of rate cuts. Right. And you know, maybe we'll get three this year, but maybe they're going to be pushed further out in the year. Or at some point, if we continue to get more surprises, it may actually impact the number of rate cuts. Right. But the market seemed to care for maybe a day, you know, maybe, right, maybe not even quite a full day. And then it said, forget that. Who cares? Right. So I'm just wondering what What's your reaction to the latest inflation data? And is it meaningful and the market's just ignoring it the way that it did all through last year? Or do you think this is just kind of a blip and yeah, don't worry about it?
Well, in the CPI, so we got two reports out. We have CPI and PPI. So let's talk about both of those. So the CPI report, and we even talked about this on our radio show, which was the day after we kind of went and analyzed that data, and there was a big divergence between shelter and actual rents. And that's not going to stick around for very long. And so the shelter component of CPI went up a lot, but the actual rent that people are paying is actually going down. And there is a huge oversupply of multifamily apartments around the country on a national basis. So rents are going to continue to be under pressure as that oversupply of apartments are out there. So we're going to continue, and as the economy slows down, that pressure will also come down on rents. So that anomaly between, and that's what the market saw through. So by the end of the day on Tuesday, the market actually recovered off the bottom fairly nicely. So we sold off pretty sharply on, oh my gosh, CPI is too hot. And so the Fed's not going to be able to cut rates so much. And then by the end of the day, the market said, oh, what, that's not going to stick. So they started rallying. And then of course, Wednesday, the markets were up pretty decently. Friday, the markets were down early in the morning on the PPI report, which also came in stronger than expected. But again, pay attention to what's going on with the data. Retail sales basically just took a huge dive this week. We saw a big decline in retail sales. We're seeing slowing economic data and other indicators as well. The National Federation of Independent Business came in weaker than expected. We're watching other indicators that are kind of more macro-oriented, showing signs of still sluggishness. And even some of the manufacturing indexes, which did improve, the internals were not great. New orders and things like that, employment were not fantastic. So there's clear evidence that the economy is slowing down. That's going to provide more of a drag on inflation. So most likely both of these numbers this month. And again, what you have to remember, we measure inflation on a year-over-year basis. So all we're doing is comparing prices today to where they were this time last year. And there's certainly some evidence. We had strong retail sales during the holidays. We've had strong economic growth in the fourth quarter. So not surprising that inflation ticked up here a bit. But that's like, and that's a lot of that's due to all this federal stimulus and federal spending that we're doing, the increase in the deficit, the CHIPS Act, all that inflation reduction money that's all kind of now hitting the economy. We've seen that tick up in economic activity. So not surprisingly, we would see a pickup in some of these inflationary pressures on a year-over-year basis. But that's going to continue to wane as we kind of move forward. It's going to be the rate of decline. And inflation is going to be slower than it was because we're not comparing year over year to a 1% increase in inflation. We're now going to be comparing it to, 0.2 to 0.1 and 0.1 to 0.3 and these type of things. So the rate of decline in inflation is still going to take longer. But, if you take a look at the 3-month average of inflation, you take a look at some of the other indicators out there, like the Truflation Index, we're already below 2% on inflation. So we're going to head towards that target for the Fed over the course of the next 12 to 18 months.
All right. I just want to note for folks too, you just mentioned Truflation there, Lance, which it's funny. I just talked about this in the video I recorded yesterday with your partner, Mike Leibowitz, which actually is going to release after this video releases. But he brought up Truflation as well. And he spent a fair amount of time talking about how, the current inflation measurement by the BLS, is highly distorted by, heuristics and all the monkeying they've done to it over the decades, where Truflation really does try to map much more to people's just regular lived experience. So anyways, I am interviewing the founder of Truflation. I can't remember exactly when, but it's in like the next week or two. So I just want to let folks know that that interview is going to be coming on. I've had a lot of people like you, Lance, that are citing Truflation more and more. So I figured, hey, let's just hear from the horse's mouth.
No, I think it's great. And again, it's just, it's just another measure of inflation. One thing that I take a look at is I look at three measures of inflation. So we look at CPI, we look at core CPI, and then I look at CPI less housing and healthcare and see what's going on there. And the reason I exclude housing and healthcare is that for most of us, right? So I rent my house right now. Right. I've been renting my house here for a little over 2 years, and my rent hasn't changed in 2 years. I'm not paying more than I was 2 years ago. I've not seen any inflation in my rent at all over 2 years. Why is that? Well, because my rent was contractually fixed over the last 2 years. Now, Adam, you may be different because you were in a rental house and then you changed houses. So your rent may have gone up because you changed houses, and maybe you rented a bigger house, or maybe it's the same size house, but because of what's going on in the economy, your rent went up, right? So, but for a lot of people, the two things that are fixed in their life, and particularly if you own a home, your mortgage payment is fixed. That doesn't adjust every month to inflation, and your healthcare costs are fixed because those are contractual. So those just change once a year when you re-up for your benefits at work or whatever. There may be an adjustment to rental costs, but our healthcare costs. But in between that, your healthcare costs are fixed for a year. So when you take a look at that index is actually still declining fairly decently towards that 2%. That's kind of more, that includes everything that, you know, people bitch about, right? So that's food and clothing and the stuff you spend money on every day, energy costs, all that. That's still in that number. And that number is actually still declining as well.
Okay. All right. So you brought up the retail sales disappointing number that just came out yesterday, which the market didn't impact the market at all. And we're in this weird, you know, world where, like, bad news is good news, right? Bad news means the Fed's not gonna have to go back to tightening. Yep. But even good news is sort of like, well, yeah, inflation went up, but nobody really trusts the housing part of it anyway, so forget that, right? It's just like, you know, like any news is good news right now in the market, right? And well, hey, that's
psychology. That's right there is all market psychology. And again, you take a look at investor sentiment, it's at extremely high levels. Investors are extremely bullish. They are very much in speculative territory. So again, when they're in that attitude, everything is good. If it's bad news, oh, that means the Fed won't have to hike rates. If it's good news, well, maybe the Fed will have to hike rates. I don't know. You know, figure it out. But the market keeps coming up with excuses as to why these things don't matter. The reason that PPI isn't going to stick is because of the retail sales data. Again, you know, if you look at PPI, the biggest jump in PPI was services costs, which is going to ultimately get that's driven by retail activity. So we're going to see, you know, that services component probably come down in the next month or so.
Okay. So I'm going to, there's a direction I want to go with this, and I'm just looking at everything I want to talk about. You're making it hard for me that you've got this constraint today, but we're going to get through as much of this as we can. let's put the markets aside for a second, because we kind of feel like it's not a super trustworthy indicator right now, right? It's just in full party on mode, right?
Right.
So let's try to help people see where the puck is heading, right? We had this disappointing retail sales. I think it was the worst year-over-year decline in retail sales that we've seen since like March or April of 2020, right? Which is when we started shutting down the global economy, right? So it's a little bit of an eye-catching stat. Now, one data point isn't a trend, so we got to keep our eye out for this. But we had that disappointing drop in retail sales that begins to just question, hey, maybe the consumer isn't as strong as we keep hearing about, and maybe, you know, they're beginning to get near the end of their ability to continue to fund their lifestyle on the credit card that the way they've been doing, you know, over the past 2 years. I've got a bunch of points here that I'm sort of working my way towards with this. We'll get to it in a minute, but I want to add to the retail sales disappointing number this stat that tax refunds are really coming in a lot less than expected. And here's a headline that pulled tax refunds crater a recessionary 57%, sparking fears about a collapse in low income spending. So basically, if you're looking at the tax data that's come in so far this year, there have been fewer returns received. That's actually a big drop. It's like negative 19% year over year. But there are fewer returns that are containing refunds. So only 19% so far versus 48% last year at the same time. So basically, there are fewer people that are having, I guess, enough income to have to do to pay taxes on. Those that are submitting returns have much fewer refunds than they did a year ago. And of the refunds that are being given, it's a smaller average refund per return, and that's down almost 30% year over year to date. So what I kind of like about that data is that's more kind of like real data, right? Like if you're paying taxes, that means you must have earned some income, right? So it
Can you hold
yep.
on there real quick though? We're a little early for that data point. And here's what I mean
Sure.
by that. Look,
It's
there's
only
absolute
mid-February. I get
right when
it.
it's only mid-February, taxes aren't due until the 15th. But we do know a couple of things. One, we do know that tax revenue has declined sharply over the last 2 years. So there's certainly something going to your point, there's certainly something going on the tax income tax side of the ledger. There is less tax revenue coming into the government over the last 2 years. And I'll look at it over a 2 year period to try to smooth out anomalies like late filing periods for California because of
Yep.
weather related events, et cetera. So it smooths all that out. Nonetheless, the rate of tax revenue is declining. So having said that, there has been a very interesting uptick. I'm seeing a lot of videos and articles getting questions from people going like, hey, I've never had to pay taxes before. Every year I get a tax refund. And now I owe taxes this year. So the reason I stopped you is that if there are individuals using things like TurboTax or whatever, and they're like, oh yeah, I'm just going to whip out my taxes real quick, get it out of the way, get my refund early. And all of a sudden it's like, what? I owe $500 or I owe $1,000. I don't have that. Now they're, instead of filing their taxes, they've got to wait to file those taxes because they can't pay the money. They got to go try to find the money first. So my point is we may see a rush of filers closer to actual tax filing day if what we're seeing in the data is real. And again, I'm just all anecdotal here, so don't go jump off a cliff and do anything. This is just anecdotal stuff I'm seeing. I'm just saying is that if this trend is correct, and the reason people are owing more taxes is because a lot of the tax cuts that were put into place under the Trump administration had a sunset provision. And we've hit that sunset. So all of a sudden, some of those tax cut provisions are going away, and that's impacting tax filers. So we may see a rush of filings, and to my point to you, Adam, is we may see a rush of filings closer to April the 15th.
Okay. Well, we won't have that long to find
Right.
out. I mean, that's only 2 months away, so we'll know. But certainly it seems like I mean, humans procrastinate to the last minute anyways, right? Which is why most people pay their taxes the night of April 15th or whenever the deadline is.
Well, you procrastinate if you owe money. You don't procrastinate if you're getting money back.
Well, that's what I was about to say. I mean, what we generally see is if you're getting a refund, well, then you file early. And that period we do see now. And I
Right,
think that's
right.
why this article was written, is it's really catching people's eyes, which is like, wow, a lot fewer people are getting refunds, and the refunds they're getting are a lot smaller. So anyways, that seems to that with I mean, who knows? We'll see if the retail sales continue to weaken. And there's a bunch of other data points I'm going to get to in a little bit. But you put that stuff together, and it starts making an argument that economic growth is going to continue to slow, and that maybe inflation will get under control on on a timeline the Fed wants. I personally think it probably will, but it's going to be not because of anything done this year. It's going to be because of things that were done the past 2 years, and it's the lag effect of all that beginning to kind of catch up with things here. You're nodding a little bit here as I'm saying this. So I want to get to my list in a second, but before we do, I want to give you a chance to talk about the article that you recently wrote about those divergences that you're seeing, and the technical warnings that you're seeing in some of your technical indicators. Just one, because I want to make sure you get those out there if there's stuff about that we haven't talked about yet. But you ended that article with sort of four bits of practical advice for investors, and I wanted folks to hear those.
Sure. Yeah. So I'll tell you what, let me jump over to that real quick and let me just pull this article up and we'll share some charts just to kind of punctuate what we're talking about. A couple of these issues will probably end as of the end of this week because depending on where the market ends, we may not be setting a new high. But there's still a lot of things that are going on that are worth paying attention to. So first of all, from a warning side of the markets, as we've been talking about, we've had 14 out of 15 weeks positive in the markets. That's a very, very long run. And again, this doesn't mean that we're about to have a big crash and that the markets are going to just fall off the cliff. It just means that we may go through a period of consolidation or some weakness, and the last half of February and March tend to be weaker months. So this market may just have trouble moving higher in the near term until we work off some of this kind of more extreme positioning in the markets. And again, you know, it's interesting now because when we look at the market where we are today, and you know, we talk about AI and talk about market cap of the AI versus, you know, the rest of the markets. For instance, you know, Microsoft, Apple, and Google have a bigger market cap together than like three economies around the world. So, you know, it's just you know, there's so much focus on this AI chase, the Magnificent Seven. And that's very reminiscent to the late 70s when we were talking about the Nifty 50, and we had the Nifty 50 running up, and it was these companies are driving the world, and that was right before the 1973-74 bear market. So again, you know, we kind of go back and look at similarities between, you know, today and the 70s. You know, we see, you know, these kind of situations that are going on. I have a good friend of mine, Albert Edwards, over at SocGen, super nice guy, very smart, did a really great piece of analysis that I was going through. And this is what I'm talking about. Take a look at the IT sector of the market. You know, it's back to where it was in 2000 in terms of market cap. You know, when you talk about earnings, we've got companies that are beating earnings, but it's all in the tech sector where we're beating earnings. Outside of the tech sector, forward earnings are actually declining and getting weaker for companies. And these are the companies that are really driven by the economy and consumption and what's going on. So once you kind of get outside of the NVIDIAs of the world and companies that are kind of tied to that AI chase at the moment, you know, earnings aren't growing. And again, we talk about valuations of what you pay for things. And there's a big gap right now between what Wall Street expects earnings to be and what's actually happening with earnings. There's this big gap between trailing earnings, what's actually reported for tax purposes, versus what Wall Street expects there to be. And again, this kind of goes back to that whole valuation issue, is that we're paying a lot more for stocks right now than they're actually worth. And it doesn't, that's not any big crisis moment. It's just saying that at some point there's going to be a reversal as markets have to reprice for what's actually happening in earnings. And right now that big gap is existing between the Fed, the markets, which still expect the Fed to cut 5 or 6 times. That's got to realign itself at some point. That's what I'm saying. Sometime this year, we'll probably get a 5 or 10% correction. And that'll be because the market finally has to acquiesce and cut its expectations of 5 to 7 rate cuts to 3. And if you're only going to get 3 rate cuts, that's a very different valuation story for the markets from getting 7.
Hey, real quick, just go back to that chart for a sec, and just asking because my brain's stuck on it. So the red line is forward EPS. The black dotted line is trailing EPS. Is that time shifted so that they line up?
Yes.
Like another. Okay.
Yeah.
So if I'm looking at the same vertical line, it is the, here's what we thought was going to come in a year from now, but here's what actually came in, and we're comparing the two. Okay.
Correct.
Yeah. So massive divergence at the end there between expectations and what we're seeing.
Right. And again, in the tech sector is basically absorbing all the inflows of money. So all the money that comes into the market, again, this is that mindless robot. Everybody's buying, you know, either the S&P, which is market cap weighted, or they're buying the tech sector index, or they're buying an AI index, whatever it is. But those tech stocks are just absorbing all the inflows coming into the market. So you've got this.
Real quick, I got to interject again, just because of that point. So important. So for folks that didn't see it, earlier this week, I interviewed Mike Green, who is the guy who coined that term, the giant mindless robot that Lance just mentioned. And Lance, he said, I'm now actually beginning to see what I've been worried about. And he put up a couple of charts that show that the net capital inflows are flattening and in some cases starting to reverse. So he said, look, I'm watching this really closely. I don't know exactly what's going to happen from here. But I just want to say that he sort of rang the bell saying, hey, I'm starting to see that thing that I've been fearing. So we'll watch that really closely going on. But obviously, folks, if those net capital inflows become net capital outflows, boy, that changes things.
Well, it does in a way, right? But, you know, this is one of the interesting issues. And this is what happened during the 2020 kind of correction that we had, because it wasn't a bear market, it was a correction. And same thing that we saw in 2022 during that correction. In both of those events, you never had people dumping ETFs en masse. And so while a lot of these big cap stocks came down some, you know, if you go back to 2022 as an example, a lot of these little small tech companies, we talked about Arc and the, you know, those disruptive technology companies
Yeah, they got
that
destroyed.
everybody wants, they got destroyed. They were down 80, 90%. Most of the big cap names, they were down 20, 25%, you know, maybe. And everybody's like, oh, FANG's dead. But nobody was actually selling their ETFs. We never saw that regurgitation of money flying out of ETFs. That's what's going to ultimately have to happen. If we're going to get to the, if we're ever going to see another 50% downturn, something's got to happen that gets the average retail investor to go, screw it, I'm out, I'm selling all my ETFs. That's, and then that reversal of flows that Mike Green's talking about, he's absolutely right. That 35% of the money that goes into Apple, Microsoft, Google, the top 10 stocks, that's when you see that reverse and those stocks lead on the way down. And then that just is the giant sucking robot that just pulls everything down with it. But you've got to get the selling to occur in those companies, and that's going to be a function of ETF dumping by retail investors. So, lastly, just real quick on this is that, you know, global equity risk love, right? We're in the massive euphoria stage. So again, just wherever you kind of look, you know, the market is just really, you know, investor sentiment's extremely bullish. You know, and this is the what I was talking about earlier about the number of stocks on breadth. That breadth is deteriorating. So this is that deterioration of the breadth relative to, and this chart's courtesy of SignalSigma.com. So they do that. They put this chart together. But this is that declining in that sentiment versus the market that's continuing to go up. So as that breadth deteriorates, that's that negative divergence that suggests normally. That's where you begin to get a correction. And you can back over here. This is where the market started correcting in July. We had that, the market was still going up and the breadth was declining. And then eventually the market caught on to it, right? So, you know, we're it's more protracted now than it was back then. And so that's what I'm saying is like we're likely going to see some type of corrective action occur, you know, probably sooner rather than later. So again, that's why it's worth paying attention to.
All right, now scroll back to the bottom because you kind of rang a bunch of warning bells here, but I think you give some pretty good advice to investors at the bottom of this.
Sorry, I know it's that I forgot about that. So yeah, you know, and this is what we were doing in our portfolio this week, and really this is the kind of the points that we're talking about here is, you know, we win our portfolio, and this is the actions that we kind of follow, which is look at your winning position, stuff that's been doing great. If it's supposed to be a 3 or 4 or 5% position in your portfolio, it's easy for us to go, oh, this is going up. I'm just going to let it run forever. And it gets to be a much larger piece in your portfolio. So then when it eventually corrects, and it will, it does more damage to your portfolio because it's too big of a position relative to your portfolio. So this is what we call concentration risk. So, you know, it's easy to get greedy and allow these positions to creep to be larger positions in your portfolio than they should be on a risk basis. And that's why if you ever look at any great investor throughout history, they always do position size management and they always measure their position sizes because that's where risk comes from. So if it's supposed to be 4 or 5% of your portfolio or 3, whatever it is, and it's now larger than that, trim it back to its original weight. So now you take a little bit of profit off. This is just a great way to take profits, right? We just trim it back to what it's supposed to be. It's like going out to your garden and you've got tomato plants. You don't pull the whole tomato plant out of the ground to get your tomatoes. You just pull the tomatoes off. And that's what you're doing here. Positions that aren't working, if they haven't been working in this market and this market rolls over, they're not going to work in a down market either. So these are stocks that you either sell entirely or reduce or, you know, replace with something else. But there's something going on with those companies that the market's not tacking onto. And when you've got a market where everything's kind of going up together and they're not, that's something to pay attention to. Move your trailing stop losses up. We use like, you know, we use moving averages. So depending on the stock, we may use the 50 or the 200-day moving average. We look for those previous levels where the stock continually kind of bounces off support. If it breaks that level of support, then it's likely going to go down lower. So you can use a moving average is a really easy way to establish a stop level for your stock, and then just review your current allocation. It's easy to get kind of out of whack to what your goals are because we all get excited, we get trapped up in this market. Oh, I need more, I want more and more return. but then you go back and, well, what was my original goal? My original goal was I just wanted to create, you know, 4 or 5% growth in my portfolio, and I'm really getting very greedy here. I need to kind of go back to my roots a bit and rebalance my risk relative to what I'm trying to achieve. And if your goal is not to lose a lot of money, measuring that risk relative to your portfolio will keep you out of trouble more often than not.
And Lance, I'm curious. I know that you have folks on your team who are kind of the front line when somebody reaches out and says, hey, you know, I want to talk with you guys about potentially working with you. You're more the portfolio manager who's determining how to allocate the client portfolios. But I'm just curious, are you seeing any sort of increase? What are you seeing right now in terms of the sentiment that are folks who are calling you up? Are they nervous about how stretched the market is, or are they more like FOMO-ish? Like, oh, you know, like my brother-in-law is making a ton of money. I want to make a ton of money too right now.
No, it's actually the function that over the last couple of years, they got super bearish, right? Because the world was going to end and they were in the bunker and, you know, everything was terrible and the debt was going to destroy the markets. And, you know, and you and I had these conversations about that really bearish kind of sentiment that was mm-hmm. sitting out there by a lot of, you know, kind of commentators. And so people that kind of bought into that narrative have been sitting in cash or, you know, a bunch of precious metals or whatever. And they're now realizing that they're missing an opportunity to grow their money. And so now, and this is always the case, right? It's always that reversal of sentiment. They're now going, okay, I made a mistake doing that. And now I need to get back into the market. So how do we go about doing that? Remember, you and I had this conversation around bonds. Everybody was jumping into short-term treasuries going, I just want the 5% yield. And now the markets are going up 5% in 2 months and they're realizing they're in the wrong place. So now we're starting to see that sentiment shift where, look, I've got to get back in the market. I've got to be more rational about my investing. So we're seeing a lot more of that.
Okay. Okay. And of course, you know, as we always say, making any decision, you know, based on strong emotion is usually not a good decision. You want to make sure that you're making a very planful, you know, non-emotionally charged decision. I guess the question I want to ask you, Lance, does this tend to be this a late stage sign, right? In other words, like do people who have been resisting getting into the party because they doubted the reasons for the party, and when they finally start to capitulate, how often does that kind of being like breaking right at the wrong time where you jump in right as the party's ending?
Well, that's why, you know, when people show up, we don't just go throw them into the market right away, because that is typically the case. You know, look, you and I were having this conversation back in 2018, 2019, you know, as well, is that, you know, we had people showing up then, this was prior to the pandemic, that had
been out
the
since the GFC.
Since 2009. And they're like, okay, I've got to get back in. And then, of course, you know, then you have the big crash. But yeah, you know, it is. It's a function of that change in sentiment that eventually, you know, and this is why we're so, you know, just every week, you know, when we're here, we continue to kind of, I know it gets annoying, but, you know, we kind of continue to pound that drum of, you know, be careful with these one-sided bets where you just kind of bank everything on some type of scenario occurring. Because, you know, for instance, a good example was de-dollarization. You know, we're going to have this big crash in the dollar, and it was because of all these reasons, and the dollar's been rallying strongly ever since. And, you know, so everybody that made that bet on de-dollarization, you know, missed, you know, everything else that occurred after that. So
Brent Johnson would say they had their milkshake drinking. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and that's, you know, we you and I have had this conversation, but that's the problem with one-sided bets. There's nothing wrong. There's absolutely nothing wrong. If you have an inherent belief that the debt or the deficit or something is going to be the end all scenario at some point, it's just going to cause mass devastation. There's ways to play that to where you can take a very small portion of your portfolio and use a position that if you're eventually right, it's going to make you a ton of money. And if you're wrong, it's not going to hurt you, right? So there's ways to do that with the options market. We can bet, you know, we can buy long-term options on the dollar or the, you know, I've got a client of mine who's very pessimistic on the markets, super nice guy, very intelligent. But he's got this kind of long-term, very bearish attitude. And so finally he and I came to an agreement. I said, here's the deal. I'm going to run the portfolio, but I'm going to buy you long-dated S&P puts. So in the event that you're right and I'm wrong, I'll be getting out of the market when the markets are crashing. But that put we're going to buy, that insurance that's out there, it'll kick in for you and it'll make you a bunch of money if that happens. And you know, that's a way to hedge some of those more bearish bets on the market. So you can do that. It's just a function of you know, figuring out what it is you're trying to do and then try to size it properly so that if you're wrong, because 85% of the time the markets are going to go up. And you know, so you got a 15% chance of being right in your bet, and you can size that bet to where being wrong doesn't hurt you.
Well, and that's if you're bearish, but I think the argument holds on the bullish side as well too, right? If you're just overly bullish and you have a one-sided bullish bet, you're open to the same risks.
Sure.
The mindset, and maybe it's worth talking about for a second, I think the mindset to cultivate, and you're the capital manager here, so you correct me if this is wrong, is, look, humans hate taking losses, and research is super clear on this, that we feel the pain of a loss twice as intensely as we feel the joy of a gain, right?
Yeah.
And so humans tend to be very, like, loss averse. And so what most people do is they come up with an investment philosophy of saying, which is the path where I think I'm not going to lose, right? Where I have a greater chance of not losing. And then I want to put all my chips there, right? Because I'm being influenced by my emotions to try to avoid loss, right? Where I think to be a successful long-term investor, you have to get the mindset of, hey, I'm going to take losses every day somewhere in my portfolio because I'm diversifying it and I've got, you know, strategies that'll do well in one type of market and strategies that'll do well in a different type of market. So I've just got to get comfortable with the fact that somewhere in my portfolio, I'm going to be taking some losses. Now, the objective here is to be taking more gains in other parts of your portfolio on the same day. And that over time, you know, your gains are outweighing your losses. And so you've got net gains that grow over time, right? And I think a lot of humans have a tough time thinking that way. So, you know, it's really important from a mindset standpoint to say, yeah, whenever, if I'm investing, you know, intelligently, I'm going to see some red on the screen practically every day. I need to emotionally get ready for that. And of course, if I'm just not seeing more green than red over time, well, then yeah, there's something wrong with my strategy. But you just got to be comfortable losing some in places. It's just part of what comes along with the territory. Do you agree?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's a problem with that strategy today that didn't exist prior to 2009.
And sorry, with which strategy? The diversified one or the single bet?
Both. But it's been easier since 2009. It's been easier to be a single bet on the S&P, right?
Well, absolutely, because you've had the put, you've had the tailwind.
Well, that's right. And so the problem, in my presentation that I did for the Economic Summit, Adam, you'll remember, I showed, you know, the S&P and the NASDAQ versus gold, the dollar, commodities, you know, everything else. And everything else. So let's say I built a portfolio back in 2010 using this diversification strategy. Because see, diversification is Harry Markowitz. That's modern portfolio theory, late 1970s. Harry Markowitz does this groundbreaking study on modern portfolio theory, all about diversification. And specifically, I mean, it's exactly what you just summed up, which was you have a little bit of loss in your portfolio over here, but you've got gains over here. And over time, those diversified assets, because one's going up and one's going down, and hopefully the ones that are going up more than the ones that are going down. But over time, you outpace markets over time because of this diversification and the rotation that occurs within markets. The problem is that since 2009, the Fed has killed modern portfolio theory because of zero interest rates, massive liquidity, and not just the Fed, but also the government, $47 trillion worth or $43 trillion worth of, you know, monetary inputs and zero interest rates has led to this massive divergence between the S&P and everything else. So if you've had this diversified strategy, you vastly underperformed domestic. It doesn't mean you lost money. It just means that you vastly underperformed what just being invested in the S&P is. That's what's made it really, really difficult for investors to run a diversified strategy, because they're watching this market go up every day and the bulk of their assets aren't performing. I tell you, I see this all the time, even with my clients. is that, you know, we run a diversified portfolio in a way, right? So we've got stocks and bonds. And, you know, it's when things are doing great, they're happy with the things that are going up. But you know, I get phone calls like, well, this one position's not working. Why don't we get rid of it, right? If everything else is going up, why is that one position not working? You know, that's just the environment we've gotten ourselves into by, you know, attaching ourselves to the mainstream media and watching the markets every day. It makes it very, very difficult for the average person to run a diversified strategy, which is good. And Adam, I'm agreeing with you that a good diversified strategy is what you should do. The problem is that the media doesn't allow us to do that anymore, and the Fed, because of this high correlation that we have now between the markets and Fed policy.
Right. And you know, we had a really good, I guess, demonstration of that in 2022, where both stocks and bonds and almost every other asset went down, right? And so the negative correlations you usually count on to counterbalance your portfolio. But I just want to underscore, I think you still agree with the point I made, and I don't think you're telling people to concentrate. I think you're telling them to have an intelligent balance of different assets in their portfolios, but I want to give you the chance to really hammer that home.
Well, no, I'm just saying is that, you know, if you're going to do that, you know, it's you can't. So for instance, you know, you can't have a portfolio today at the moment that is 25% stocks and 75% other stuff, because you're going to vastly underperform the index and you're going to wind up selling all that stuff to buy the index probably at the peak of the market when the other stuff would eventually work. So, you know, that's so you've got to keep these bets that you make well aligned with what the probabilities of success are going to be. And again, this is all about measuring risk and reward. So this is why, you know, we do so much analytical work, like in our weekly newsletter that you're now publishing on your Substack. We have all these analysis that we do, you know, at the bottom of the newsletter about risk reward ranges and market sector relative performance, this type of stuff to measure that risk reward that you're going to pick up by adding some, you know, potential bet to your portfolio to capitalize on a small probability event. So it's important to, it's okay to have this diversification, but you have to make sure, and the weighting is incredibly important to the overall portfolio structure.
Okay, so you're kind of making a point here for, I think, diversification plus active management, right?
Yeah,
Which is
if you're going to diversify, you got to have active management. That's the whole point.
the whole, yeah. Well, but not a set it and forget it. I'm just going to
Right,
have
right.
25% stocks, 25%, right? You're basically saying, hey, look, you know, you got to have somebody there who's really like looking at all those different divergences in performance and saying, hey, you know, I might need to concentrate a little bit more in this part of the portfolio and reduce a little bit here, but then be
Right.
ready to change if things on
Correct.
the ground change. Okay. Would love to keep digging into that, but I'm really sweating the time here now. So I told you the other week that I went on Fox Business, and it was so funny because my first like major mainstream TV appearance, and I didn't want it to be like a total disaster, so I wanted to plan for it. And I as the date was getting closer, I said, what do you guys want to talk about? And they said, well, we're not really sure. And I said, well, how about I give you a couple of ideas and you can decide what you want? And they said, yeah, that'd be great. So I sent them five ideas, and they responded, yeah, these are wonderful. I was like, wait, no, you're supposed to pick one of those. I got to prepare, right? So I prepared this whole thing, this whole list of bullets. Of course, TV being TV, they actually asked me something totally different than what I planned for. And in 2.5 minutes, I probably only got through two of the bullets on this whole thing. But I thought it was worth it to go through this. And I think this, you know, weekend video with you is the right thing to do it. So my point was sort of, look, we're all being told how strong the economy is and how we're in Goldilocks and how, you know, things just look amazing. And we're hearing that, you know, in all the headlines, but we're certainly hearing it from both Powell and Janet Yellen. And my point was, look, if this isn't feeling like a strong economy to you personally, right? If this is a part of the economy is having, and you don't feel like you've been invited to it, like you're not alone. And actually, you're not crazy either. So I pulled a bunch of stats, and I just want to bang through a bunch of them, and then I'll let you respond to them, Lance. But mostly, we hear that Look, inflation's coming under control. The stock market's at new highs. GDP is growing faster than folks expected, and the job market remains wicked strong, right? So let me just unpack some of those for a minute. Okay, yeah, inflation is down in the threes now, right? Okay, yay, it's coming down, but of course, a decline in inflation still means prices are going up, right? I mean, as long as it's still a positive increase in inflation, prices are still going up. They're just not going up as fast as they were. Consumers are still reeling from the explosion in the cost of living that we've seen, you know, since the pandemic and those trillions and trillions of stimulus that you mentioned there, Lance. 60% of Americans report that they're living paycheck to paycheck. Groceries are up 25% since 2020. And these are using official numbers. I think Trueflation would probably have higher numbers. And pre-COVID, it was going up 2% a year, right? But now we've had 25% in roughly 4 years. Housing, cars, insurance, utilities, they've all seen similar double-digit increases, some actually a lot more than what we've seen in groceries. So, like, we definitely have taken the injury of our cost of living's gone up substantially, but wages have not caught up. They have not increased at the same amount. Now, we have had recently positive wage growth, but 60% of workers report that their wages have not kept up with the cost of living. All right. So we're hearing how great things are in inflation, but we're just saying, look, you know, I'm not seeing the cavalry coming anytime soon. Stock markets has hit new highs, which is great, but as we've talked about, who owns these, right? 93% of stocks are owned by the top 10% of households. So the increase in the market isn't super directly relevant to most people out there. We're now at the part where, you know, this increase in financial assets is rewarding the top households so much that we have, you know, the worst wealth inequality that we've had in like forever. We just passed the milestone where the top 1% of American earners now own more wealth than the entire middle class, right? And how healthy is this market? And you just, you know, talked about this, right? It's got some of the weakest breadth that we've seen ever. Equity risk premiums are super low. And if the lag effects from, you know, all the things that we've talked about in this channel, Lance, the rate hikes, QT, you know, all this stuff, starts really hitting in force, and corporations are forced to start cutting costs to try to preserve their margins, you know, that could turn stocks around in a hurry, right? Who knows? We're gonna track it, but basically, just saying, the specter of the lag effects is still hanging out there. The GDP growth, yeah, we've talked about how GDP now, you know, keeps going up. I think it's still over 4% for Q1 right now in terms of their predictions.
Actually, that's 2.9 as of yesterday because of the retail sales.
Oh, really? Okay, so that did just roll over. Okay, so interesting. So 64% of all employees say they're stressed about finances. That jumps to 90% for millennials aged 35 to 44, right? Housing's more unaffordable than ever. We know that. This stat blows my mind. Home prices are unaffordable in 99% of the nation for the average American, right? Just bananas. It's also now unaffordable for a record half of all U.S. renters. So as a result, we're seeing consumers struggle to continue to fund their lifestyles, and they're putting more and more of it on credit, as we've talked about the explosion in use of credit cards at record high APRs on those credit cards. And we're seeing the rise of new forms of ways to finance, like buy now, pay later, which is a clear sign that consumers can't afford their purchases. In the colloquial language, we're now hearing terms like doom spending emerge, right? Which is where people are just so depressed about their prospects that they're kind of paying for treats now because I may as well do something that makes me feel good today, even if tomorrow's going to suck worse, right? Delinquency rates on credit cards and auto loans have spiked to their highest since the Great Recession. Even the wealthy are starting to cut down on their spending. We're seeing luxury brands start beginning to see profit disappointments. So there's a luxury showdown, which I know almost no viewer here is going to shed a tear for. But it shows that cohort of top spenders are even beginning to sort of tighten their purse strings a bit. And a lot of data has suggested that they've kind of been what's continued to support consumer spending up until recently. So, you know, maybe those people who were willing to spend the most are starting to spend less going forward. And then, of course, we've got the corporate maturity wall that's hanging out there. And I think there's roughly $2 trillion of corporate debt that's going to re-rate this year and next year alone. Last, and then I'll let you talk here, the strong jobs market. Layoffs are increasing. They're actually... there were 98% more layoffs in 2023 than there were in 2022. But the activity in 2024 has picked up vastly faster than the rate of layoffs in 2023 itself. We've seen tens of thousands of folks already laid off in 2024, and those were across a whole range of industries. A lot of small companies, but big ones too, like Alphabet, Amazon, Citigroup, Charles Schwab, Levi's, UPS, Washington Post. If the pace of that picks up from here, then everything that we were worried about just gets worse, right? If consumers start getting laid off in enough volume that either they can't spend because they've lost their job, or they see their neighbors lose their job and say, you know, that could come to me, I'm going to start saving more. That just creates that vicious cycle of less consumer spending going off. Almost done. Official payroll numbers from the BLS, you know, I think nobody believes them anymore. Even the people that used to cheerlead the BLS are saying, yeah, I can't defend these numbers anymore. And we talked about the difference of the latest BLS survey, which had the amazing, you know, huge surprise in the 353,000 new jobs as reported by their establishment survey. But then you go and you look over at the household survey, it says we actually lost 35,000 jobs, right? Quits are declining, which is showing that power is shifting back to the employers. The economy is now 68% consumer spending. So end of the story here. For everything I just mentioned here, you know, there's a lot of consumers that don't feel like they're part of this party. They're not doing so hard. And as consumer spending goes, so goes the economy. So the whole point here was just basically to say, look, if you're feeling like everybody's talking about this massive party and you don't feel like you got an invitation to it, you're not alone. The vast, vast majority of the country is in the same boat as you. So I'll stop here and take my breath. But I mean, that's a pretty big preponderance of data that says, you know, things aren't as perfect as we seem to be being sold here.
Well, they're not. And I don't think, you know, none of that's really a surprise. And, you know, ultimately, it's going to matter. It just doesn't matter right now because the markets are all enveloped into this, you know, AI chase, and the markets are going up. So I want to be in the market. And again, you know, we're talking about markets every week, and we're talking to a very small group of people. I mean, people that don't have any money invested, they're not watching Thoughtful Money. I mean, they're doing other stuff today. So, you know, if people have money in the markets or they're concerned about their finances, they're the ones that are watching, you know, this channel to make sure that nothing's going to sneak up and bite them that's going to ruin their retirement. But that's a very small group of the population. I mean, I don't think people really, really understand that if you have more than about 300,000 in the bank, you're in the top 2 or 3% of the population in terms of wealth. You know, and you talk about, you know, 250, 300,000. It doesn't sound like that much money, but when you look at the average American, and we talked about this, I think last week, I wrote the article about retirees taking on so much risk, you know, for retirement. And you take a look at across age brackets, individuals think they need, you know, 1.5 million, 1.6 million to retire on. And across all age brackets, they all have less than $200,000 saved up for retirement at most. So, you know, there's just this, you know, when we're talking about markets and money and all this has nothing to do, you know, there's this huge detachment between what's happening in the markets, because that's reflected in valuations, and what's happening in the real economy. And those two will eventually meet up at some point, at some crossroad down the way, and valuations will matter. They just don't matter right now. You know, I did an article today. It was very interesting. I thought, you know, Jerome Powell made a very interesting statement, you know, talking about employment. And you just mentioned the employment numbers, and that, you know, we have this big divergence between the household survey. Well, we also have this big divergence between native born workers and foreign born workers. We have a very big divergence. You know, almost all the jobs created have either been government or temporary work. We're not, and we talked about full-time employment declining. I thought it was interesting. Jerome Powell said, he was in an interview on 60 Minutes, and Scott Pelley asked him, he says, why is immigration important? Now, importantly, we don't none of these conversations, when we talk about immigration, we never separate between legal and illegal immigration. We just call it immigration. But Powell made a very interesting statement. He says, because, you know, immigrants come in and they tend to work at a rate that is at or above that for non-immigrants who came to the country. Immigrants who came to the country tend to be in the workforce at a slightly higher level than Native Americans. So in other words, what he's saying is that non-Native immigrants that are coming in, those workers, they work at a higher rate. In other words, they work harder than average Americans.
Right, which makes sense. If you fight to come into the country legally and go through all those hoops, you're doing it because you want to come here for the opportunity.
Right, but it's also on the illegal side as well.
Sure.
Because they work for lower wages. And this is something that we're seeing. Even the CBO recently did a study, and they said, look, when we talk about how employment works, I'm just going to quote you a couple of points from the CBO. They said reductions in employment would initially be concentrated at firms where higher prices quickly reduce sales. So that's where inflation makes an impact. So where do they start cutting expenses? The most important part, which is layoffs. That's what you're talking about. So over a longer period, however, firms would replace low-wage workers with higher-wage workers, machines, and other substitutes. So again, this is where why AI is so important. This is why robotics is so important, because we're replacing more and more of our workforce with automation, and particularly in areas that can be automated, like lower wage paying jobs, manufacturing, assembly work, et cetera. Even if I'm going to onshore that, I'm going to automate most of it, because again, I've got to reduce that cost of labor. As employers pass on those costs to consumers, consumers purchase fewer goods and services. So that's inflation. Inflation goes up, I buy less, that impacts profitability for corporations. So consequently, employers produce fewer goods and services, they spend less on capital expenditures. And when the cost of employing low-wage workers rises, the cost of investing in machines and technology goes down. So, you know, as American workers start asking for higher minimum wages and all this, they either get replaced by automation or they get replaced by lower wage workers, which, and when you talk about where's all the jobs been created, it's been where, Adam? It's been in leisure, hospitality, retail, fast food services. And that's where a lot of this illegal immigration.
Right, the low-cost labor is, yeah.
They are low-cost labor, and they're taking those very important for Native Americans that, you know, when you talk about 16 to 25 years old, their first job out of high school tends to be at fast food restaurants, right? They're a line cook or whatever they're doing at Burger King or McDonald's. That's their first work experience. Those jobs are not available to them. And now we're seeing that translate up into the workforce. This whole article about that I wrote on Friday is talking about, there's been numerous articles, the Wall Street Journal, Business Insider and others are writing articles talking about these college students that are graduating cannot find work.
Right, which we talked about, I think, last week. I mean, I'm seeing that in real time because I've got, you know, college age daughter, and I'm seeing, you know, a surprising number of her peers who these were kids who really succeeded in college, right, coming out of a STEM school and still having trouble finding, you know, entry level work. Yep. Where I think in previous business cycles, these kids would have been snapped up, you know, almost sort of sight unseen. Yep. All right. So I had a rant, probably not going to get a chance to get to it because I want to mention this, which builds off your recent point here is we're trending into a different topic. You know, the topic I wanted just to underscore with everything I just ran through here, which is that when we talk about where the puck's headed, and I think you agreed with me, Lance, which is the market is quite disconnected from the trajectory of the market is quite disconnected from the trajectory of the economy. They're going to have to meet up at some point. When that happens, who knows? I'm not, you know, I think most of us would love for it to happen this year so we can just get back to some sane area. It might not happen for a decade or two. Who knows, right? The video that I released before this one is with Chris Hamilton of the website Economica. And he is this prolific chartist. And Lance, I don't know if you recognize the name, but you definitely recognize his charts if you've seen him. You've seen him all over Twitter and Zero Hedge and a lot of the places that we, you know, your content's shared. And one of the things that he really focuses on is demographics. And so we did a deep dive into US demographics, and he basically showed how economic growth is super highly correlated with your population of workers in the 25 to 54 age band. And you can see, over the 20th century, how we were growing the absolute number of people in that age cohort. I think up until, and I'm doing this from memory, but I think up until like the 80s. And it's been declining ever since. And as it has declined, the amount of debt that we've taken on has had to continually increase. And essentially what we've done is we've switched from using people power to power our economy to using debt to power economic growth. And, using debt to power economic growth is pulling tomorrow's prosperity into today. So you're kind of stealing from your future, and you get to diminishing returns, where you need to have more and more debt to get the same amount of economic growth, and eventually you get to the point where the debt is just making the problem totally worse, right? So you've got your own charts that seem to be very similar of all this. So it's great. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. So what was critical about his charts is he said, look, if you look at births and deaths in America, right now, if status quo continues, by 2035, we're going to have passed the point where for the natural population of the country, we will start shrinking. Never happened before in American history. And if you look at the current inflows and outflows for immigration, both legal and illegal, all of our population growth coming after 2030 is going to come from some form of immigration. And even that will start declining by around 2050. So we're not that far away from the period where we're not going to be growing our populace anymore. And of course, during that trajectory, as you've shown, one of the big things that's driving that to this chart is we're just having a lot fewer babies. And that's largely because the younger generations, it's just become a lot more expensive and a lot more uncertain. And so the younger generations are forming families at a lower rate, and they're having fewer births. But that key cohort of 25 to 54 year olds keeps on shrinking as time goes on here. So you had this chart here, which shows that our elderly population, the percentage of the population that's older and increasingly unproductive, is exploding right now, right? So where I'm kind of going with all this is it just begs the question of how are you going to grow your economy when your population becomes stagnant, when your population of productive workers is in an advanced decline, and you've gotten to the point where debt can't help the situation anymore, right?
Right.
So we're going to have to reconcile that problem, that massive problem, in the not too distant future. A decade or two away from now, yeah, it feels far away to some people, but historically, that'll be here in the blink of an eye. That's a big conversation. Wait, one that requires more time than we have here, but sounds like you are concerned about this sort of date,
Well, yeah, no,
this
look. It,
deadline with demographic destiny.
well, look, and there's an old saying. It says demographics are destiny. And look, if you want to grow an economy, you grow your population, because the more population that you have that's of working age and consumption age, that's where economic growth comes from. We're 70% driven by consumption. So if you want to grow the economy, the more people producing, again, in order to grow, in order to consume, we have to produce first. So we need more people producing. And when they produce more, then they consume more. And so that's what creates economics. The problem is that, there's no argument. Let me just be clear right now. There is absolutely no argument we have to have immigration because we are not producing enough children. This is China's problem. This is Japan's problem. Japan just went back into a recession. So the reason that they have a demographic problem, that's why they can't grow their economies. And so at some point, we're going to have to incentivize Americans to have children. How do you do that? Well, you give them tax credits, tax breaks, whatever you want, in order to incentivize them to have children. Unfortunately, we have the me generation going on right now. And younger people are like, I don't want kids. This is all about me. I want to go live my life. I want to travel. I want to have big cars and houses. I'm going to do all this stuff I see on social media.
Well, that,
I
but
can't.
you're
I
going to have a
can't do
bunch
that.
of folks saying, hey, I'm a millennial, and it's freaking expensive and hard to have kids. So
It is,
keep that in
but
mind.
Yeah, it is, but you make do, right? I've got four, so I never wanted kids, but I've got four, so be careful what you wish for. Anyway, but the point is that we've got to have immigration. The problem, though, is that we can't have illegal immigration, and the reason you can't have illegal immigration is because you import lower skilled, lower wage, lower education workers. You want immigration that is legal but merit-based. In other words, we want to encourage people to come here that have higher levels of education, come here with capital. They create businesses, they employ other workers. That's the type of immigration you need. When President Trump was in office, this was one of the things that he talked about in terms of immigration, is having a merit-based immigration system to import those workers. We educate a vast majority of the world's doctors and engineers and everything else. And then they go back home to be doctors, engineers, et cetera, in other countries. They go to MIT, they go to Harvard, then they go back home. We
Right.
want to retain those workers here in the
Well,
United States. We want to retain that education.
it just started to interrupt, but I agree. One of the problems is a lot of those guys want to stay here and they can't. So we have policies that are actually pushing those guys away right now.
That's absolutely right. And this is the problem with the immigration laws that we have. We do need to rework our immigration policies to make it easier to immigrate. I mean, look, there's a lot of things you could do, and we talked about this before, but if you come here to America and you create a business that employs 10 people over the course of 5 years, you get your citizenship. You come here and serve in the military for 5 years, you get your citizenship. You come here and you bring capital and create a business, or you come here and have your bring your education, your skills, you work for a company for 5 or 10 years, you get your citizenship. You can make the pathway to citizenship much easier and much less expensive. It is so expensive. I've immigrated people here before, and it is so costly to go through the immigration process. Employers like me just don't want to pay for it. It's too time consuming, it's too expensive, and even though it's worth it, the problem is that once they go through that immigration process, you sponsor them and you pay for it, and it's all the cost. Then they leave and go get another job somewhere else, right? Once they're a citizen. So, it's very difficult to be an employer, and you need to remove that barrier and allow employers to hire immigrants on a merit-based system that says, hey, I want that education, come work for my company. Make it cheaper, make it easier, make it faster for them to become a citizen. So they'll stay here, they'll pay taxes, they'll raise families, they encourage employment. Those are the type of things you need to grow your economy long term.
All right, so totally agree with you, and I hate the fact that we got to wrap this up quickly because this is such a key important topic. And folks, I do commit to bringing on more specialists to sort of talk about this key immigration issue, because the whole point of this, and I'm going to turn off your chart here, Lance.
That's all right.
The whole point of this is if we want to grow our economy, then we need to address this shrinkage we have of key working age Americans, productive Americans, right, or productive citizens. And to do that, we have to pull the levers that Lance talked about here, right? We've got to provide incentives for folks here to have more children. But it seems pretty clear from the math side that if we want to continue to grow our economy, we are going to have to patch a lot of the gap for some foreseeable part of the future, measured in decades, by immigration. So, the question is what immigration strategy is going to best serve us? And I think that's the really important part of the discussion we want to have here.
And
We'll
there's
have
and
that in the
real
future. Go ahead.
right, but real quick, there's one other really crucial point to this that you can't overlook, and that is our Social Security welfare, kind of our Medicaid system. We had 16 people paying into Social Security when it was first formed. We have less than two now, and we keep adding more and more people to the roll. Just this past week, the Biden administration rolled out a policy that will now allow Arizona and Oregon to tap $1.5 billion worth of Medicaid to house the homeless.
Right.
Now, I am not against housing the homeless, but again, what we've done over the years, the reason that Social Security, Medicaid is always underfunded and is on the brink of bankruptcy, and these are all the conversations that we have consistently, is that we keep adding more and more people. Every time there's a special class of people we want to help, we stick them on to welfare. And that just puts more people taking money out of the system than paying in. So we need to bring in these higher, and again, when we talk about immigration, we need higher skilled, higher wage earning individuals because they pay more in taxes. Yes, illegal immigrants pay taxes, but they pay it at the lowest level because they're lower wage earning individuals. So we need higher tax paying individuals that will pay into this welfare system to help support it long term. So you need that population growth. But you know, we can pass a $100 billion bill to fund Ukraine, but we can't pass a $20 billion bill to house the homeless. You know, but instead we're going to tack it onto Medicare and Medicaid, which is essentially an $80 trillion unfunded liability. We just keep making it worse.
So you're making my point for me, which is there's just massive amount of policy reform that has to go along with this, both in terms of who we bring in, but also how we spend money and allocate it internally. And you're right. We've stolen from Peter to pay Paul for so many decades. And look, can kicking, that's the superpower of today's American politician, right? But you can't kick the can any further down the road when you're dealing with reality constraints. Like, we just don't have the number of people here to produce the economic growth that we want. So anyways, big hairball question, but super, like, economically for us, it's existential. Right. Like, we really have to start having this discussion and figuring out what solutions are the right ones and which ones we want to, you know, agitate for with our elected officials, right? So that's all coming up. We're going to have to just punt that for a later day here, but thanks for kicking it off for me here, Lance. There's also one really big question, which I just want to put out there, which we'll address later on, but is, I said, if you want to grow your economy, you have to solve this problem. There is a question that says, hey, look, you know, we've got a finite amount of land here in America, right? Like, we can't grow our population to infinity. So at some point in the future, there's a date with a destiny of, there's some maximum number of people that we can have here in this country. And what do you do when you get to the point where you can't grow your population anymore? Like, what type of economy do you have will work in that world? It's an interesting academic exercise.
It is, but look, you've got states like Wyoming that have a total population of 500,000 people.
Oh yeah, look, it's going to take us a long time.
We got tons of space for people.
We do. That's a long-term problem, but just intellectually, to me, that's an interesting question, which is, right now we have an economy that is based on eternal forever growth. You can't have that forever. So what economy do you have when you can't have that, right? But that's for a different day. So real quick, Lance, trades from last week.
Basically, just a little nipping and tucking. We trimmed off NVIDIA, Microsoft, Google, Apple, added a little bit to Comcast and FANG, which was Diamondback Energy. Had a great week this week because they acquired Endeavor. So it's just been basically just a little movement, nothing major.
Okay. I'm just curious, has this been kind of fun start to the year for you guys, just because kind of everything's going up?
Yeah, we're having a ball. Much better than summer of last year. So,
all right. Well, real quick for folks, if you are, looking how to maybe take advantage of some of this stuff in the near term, but probably more importantly, figuring out, okay, how do I actually allocate, given the fact that the party's still raging, but there's lots of signs that it might be ending at some point soon, and then we may have some of the uncertainty later on in the year that Lance mentioned. Highly recommend that most people watching here work under the guidance of a professional financial advisor who takes into account all the issues that we've talked about here, maybe even Lance and his team there at Real Investment Advice. So if you've got a great advisor who's doing that for you, obviously great, stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion from one of these guys that Thoughtful Money endorses, head over to thoughtfulmoney.com, fill out the short form there. Remember, these consultations that you get, they're totally free. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a free public service that Lance and the other advisors offer. And if you dream of a future where we've solved the whole American population issue to power the economy for forever and ever to better and better heights, and want to see Lance at the forefront of that movement, do us a favor, hit the like button, and then click the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. A reminder as well that the Thoughtful Money Conference is coming up fast. We're now exactly a month away. That's going to be again on Saturday, March 16th. Don't worry if you can't attend the event live, because replay videos of the entire event, including all the live Q&A sessions, will be sent to everybody who registered within 24 hours of the event's ending. The faculty continues to grow. It's going to be a phenomenal time. Lance is going to be there. And a reminder that right now we still have that early that lowest early bird discount price still out there. It's not going to last for too much longer. So if you're thinking about coming to the conference, register now, lock that in. And if you're a premium subscriber to our Substack, remember that you get an additional $50 off of that lowest early bird price. And remember to sign up for the Substack. It only costs $15 a month. I am totally happy if you game the system by subscribing just for a month to get that. You know, that'll cost you $15, but you'll save the larger $50. You put $35 in your pocket. I'm totally happy with that. I want you to get the lowest price. All right. And in wrapping up here, Lance, I will let you have the last word as always. What parting bits of advice do you have for folks?
Look, enjoy the markets while they last. They're doing great. Nothing to worry about right now. But if something changes, we'll let you know.
All right. Lance, buddy, it's always great having you on here. Look forward to seeing you next week. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.